Good afternoon, everybody. Even though we're not in session and we're just doing informational hearings, we do have quite a bit to cover this afternoon, so I'd like to call us to order and get us started. So welcome to the committee. We're going to first hear House File 2023, Representative Fritz's bill. Let me just remind everybody that even though we're not in session and we can't take official action on the bills, that these really are hearings, and because of our process with having an omnibus bill this year, some of these bills may become part of the omnibus bill, and then you'll next see them when the omnibus bill is revealed, or the draft omnibus bill. So we do want to make sure that we ask our questions and treat these seriously. Yes, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification from your opening remarks yesterday with regard to the process. My understanding is that each of these bills is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Will there be an opportunity for amendments to each individual bill, or only at the time that they're rolled into or included in the omnibus bill itself? Just want to have some clarification in terms of what my understanding was from last session to this session, if there's been a change in terms of the structure of amendments or structure in terms of protocol for listening to the bills and activities that we might have with each one of the bills.
Yeah, Representative Albright, some of the bills we'll be hearing will be going to other committees. And so those bills we will vote out, and we'll go through the regular process, amendments and so on, before we vote on them. But bills that are just being laid over for possible inclusion, we may or may not amend them at that time. Probably not. There will certainly be a full opportunity to amend the bills if they come back in the omnibus bill, or to amend them in if they're not in the omnibus bill. So it's kind of incumbent on each member to sort of keep track. We're hearing a bill and you think, gee, if that thing comes back, I want to make sure I offer X amendment, probably need to keep track of that.
Right.
That's what I'm thinking right now with our process.
Thank you.
This is great.
Okay, anything else from members? Okay, all right. Representative Fritz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm very honored to have the opportunity to bring this bill to this committee today. Personally, I am the great-grandmother of Lily, a one-pound infant who is a year February 1st, 1 pound 3 ounces, and we have certainly had our share of nursing service in that area. And I have with me some folks that can speak more to that, but I want to talk about House File 2023 today. I have a delete all also amendment, but I understand we're not taking any action on any of that, but we'll be working off of that, and there's some good information in your packets. House File 2023 would update private duty nursing services in three important ways. Private duty nursing services currently covers care for the sickest Minnesotans cared for in a home care setting by the highest skilled nurses using complex medical technology to care for the patients. House File 2023 would provide a more accurate description of the type of nursing services being provided for these patients, home care nursing services. The bill would add a new third level of home care nursing services to reflect great changes in medical technology and home care nursing skill levels that have occurred over the last two decades. And third, House File 2023 provides for payment rate increase for home care nursing services that would solve the problem of recruitment and retention that home care nursing agencies struggle with. And with that, Madam Chair and members, I would like to have the testifiers, Lisa Flynn, registered nurse, and Dr. Roy Maynard also, and Joan Vaughn. I'll turn it over to them.
Lisa. Hello, Madam Chair and members.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
I'm going to be speaking towards the definition change specifically to eliminate the private duty nursing.
Okay, could you just state your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Lisa Flynn.
Okay.
I work at Hiawatha Home Care, and I'm also a founding member of the Professional Home Care Coalition. And I've been in home care with Hiawatha Home Care for 25 years, taking care of these types of clients.
Please
personally. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. Private duty nursing is known to as the private pay non-physician directed care, as all insurance companies recognize that, and to have the name change will help separate what we are really truly providing into the home, which is not private duty, as all of the nursing care we provide is all physician directed, and it will eliminate the insurance companies from saying that we are trying to provide an excluded service, which has created quite a stir in the last few years. This is a very valid piece to define what we truly are providing and not something that we are not providing, because we are not doing private duty care per se.
Okay.
Any questions?
Okay, did members have questions on that at all? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the witness. Just to make sure that I understood your last statement, does that mean that it will be less hassles for people to make claims against their long-term care insurance then, and that this is nomenclature that industry will respect? Because I have heard of people having problems being able to make what seem to be legitimate claims against those policies.
Ms. Flynn?
Thank you, Madam Chair and member. It will help not so much the long-term care insurance, but the private insurance sector, like Blue Cross Blue Shield, Medica. They don't reimburse for private duty nursing, and even though the statute says if it's a fully insured plan and they have MA backup, or MA also they have to, this will help define that we're not requesting a service that is in every insurance plan as written as an exclusion. This will help them know that we're requesting this service, but we're billing, and not the private duty.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I do think that's an area that we need to look at as well. If we're trying to clarify this, that maybe we can talk with some people with the Commerce Department about, you know, making sure that whatever we're doing works for all forms of insurance and is respected and interpreted in the same way.
Thank you. Okay. Do you have another testifier?
I do, and I'll just respond also to Representative Loeffler.
Please.
I serve on Commerce, and this would be a good area. I'd like to clean that up as well. So anything more that we can do to offer and give this service and have people understand it and have it paid for is right up my alley. Another testifier.
Right.
Are you Joan? If go ahead and introduce
Thank yourself. You, Representative mm-hmm. Fritz. Yeah, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Joan Vaughn. I own a nursing agency, and I'm also a representative of the Professional Home Care Coalition. I've owned a home care agency for 15 years. I started my agency for my infant daughter who needed home care for 5 years. I'm a founding member of the Professional Home Care Coalition, a group of home care agencies dedicated to improving the standards of home care. We want to establish best practices and tools and work cooperatively with legislators, DHS, and MDH. Many Minnesotans don't know the face of home care, extended hours nursing. As Dr. Maynard will testify, we take care of Minnesota's most vulnerable population, those with long-term medically complex conditions such as ventilator dependence, tracheostomies, life-sustaining IV medications. We're providing ICU level of care in the home for long-term patients. We often staff cases 24 hours a day for years at a time in order to let our patients live at home with their families and in their communities, which is a significant cost savings over facilities and adds to the client's quality of life. The current reimbursement rates for hourly nursing in the home are comparable to the rates we received in 2006. The cost of living has increased substantially since that time, and agencies are not able to sustain the best clinical and business practices on the current rates. In 2013, my company spent 77% of reimbursement rates on nurse wages and workers' compensation. That leaves a thin 23% for director of nursing, nursing clinical training, nursing supervision, an appropriate office facility for interviewing and training, human resources, ethical and accurate billing, and everything else it takes to run a sustainable business. That leaves little profit, if any. In fact, agencies routinely lose money on the regular reimbursement rate, as all the agencies in this room can attest to. Insurance plans routinely exclude home care nursing from their plans, forcing Minnesota's most vulnerable population to rely exclusively on medical assistance for their nursing. Our current reimbursement rates are financially unsustainable and must be increased to ensure that agencies can sustain best clinical and business practices and continue serving our clients. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions for members for this testifier? Okay, thank you very much. And we have one more. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dr. Roy Maynard. I am boarded in general pediatrics. I'm boarded in newborn intensive care medicine and also in pediatric lung medicine. I have been intimately involved in the care of medically complex children for 3 decades. I am licensed in the state of Minnesota, and I am also a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Executive Committee on Home Care for Children. In the past 10 years, the population of medically complex children in our communities has doubled. You go to a children's hospital anywhere in the United States now, 30% of the beds are filled with medically complex kids, and they consume a disproportionate amount of health care dollars that is spent on pediatrics. We are having a problem getting these kids home. These kids are having prolonged hospitalizations, they're having readmissions, and some of this can be related to the inadequacy of hiring skilled nurses and retaining these skilled nurses in the home. We cannot match the salaries of the hospitals, we cannot match the benefits of the hospitals, and these nurses are well trained through our community, our home care community, and then they get employed by the hospitals and we lose them. Go to any of the discharge planners in our hospitals, in the pediatric hospitals in the community here, and ask them what one of the major problems getting the kids home, and they will tell you that it's getting skilled nursing care for these kids. The level of medical complexity of these children going home today is exponentially higher than when I was an intern 30 years ago. And that is not changing. The population is increasing. Our advances in medical technologies, our advances in the surgical skills of our pediatric surgeons and those doctors who operate on those tiny little hearts are getting these kids home, but we're not necessarily liberating from their technologies. And without appropriate payment for these skilled nurses, who are no different than a nurse walking in a hospital, except that nurse in the hospital has got a code blue button, she's got a resident outside the door, she's got a hospitalist at the end of the street. These nurses in the home have to make second-by-second decisions for these kids with extremely complex cares, and they're getting more complex.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Thank you, Dr. Maynard. I wonder if you could, I've got one question here, but I wonder if you could just give us a very short you talked about how much more complex these kids are than when you were a resident. Could you just give us sort of a few examples of what we're talking about?
Madam Chair, members, there's a condition called ectopia cordis where the child is born with the heart outside of the body. You go through the medical literature. The majority of those children die. We recently took care for a child like that who went home with a plastic shell so that the nurses could watch the kid so he didn't roll over on where they had put a skin graft over the baby's heart. We have babies living at home on ventilators who have one ventricle pumping all the blood to their lungs and to their body. Those are just a couple of examples of the level of complexity.
Thank you. I had a question, I think, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair and Dr. Maynard, it's implied that it would be cost beneficial to treat in the home with the rate increases, and I was just wondering, can you give us any idea of how much savings we could hope to accrue as a result?
You know, I wish I could give you that answer, and actually when I was on our conference call for the subcommittee on home care, I kind of asked that question. The problem is that, you know, across the nation, it's difficult to account for these patients because in the world of healthcare, medically complex children are a very small part compared to the rest of the universe in healthcare. But we are looking at doing a study on that with the discharge planners in the children's hospitals, and we're formulating that. We have to present it to the institutional review boards, and we are trying to come up with some definitive numbers. But in the literature now, you will not find any definitive numbers, but you will find clearly implications that it is more cost-effective, for sure, to keep children at home and prevent their readmission and help facilitate an early discharge.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair and Dr. Maynard, then kind of a corollary question would be, in general, is there do the children benefit from being home?
Dr. Maynard.
Madam Chair, members, there is no question on that. There are a lot of studies that have shown that if you look at parent satisfaction, they're very much happy. They want these kids home. They're sick and tired of living in a hospital and eating hospital food and having to ferry back and forth between their children and their jobs and keeping their house up. There's lots of data that shows that when these children go home, neurodevelopmentally, they make extreme progress in a home environment where they're being nurtured by their family who loves them, with their siblings. But you still have to have nursing care because it's very important. If you don't have help for these parents, the burnout rate for sure contributes to rehospitalization. There's a lot of data to support that. And it also is very important from what we call the forgotten siblings. Those other children in the home, if the parents are tied up doing all those cares round the clock, it's a problem for the forgotten siblings. And if you don't relieve some of those stresses, there's an increased divorce rate in these families caring for medically complex children.
Representative Johnson? Okay, thank you. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair, and for the testifiers. And just to the bill in general, I think it's a really solid piece of legislation for the two parts. The definitions have to be right, and I think there's more wordsmithing to go forward, irrespective of what the health plans do, just so we understand, and there's a third category, not just two. And on the money thing, hopefully DHS is listening, and there'd be some way to figure out how many these kids and other, this isn't just for kids, this is for a lot of people, I think. It's adults and others who are trapped in a hospital someplace because there's not enough of these off-site nursing, whatever the new terms are, that you're coming up with. So they're discharge ready to the right site and incurring, I would think, three times as much. And if they're on medical assistance, that's our dime. And so hopefully that when Chair Huntley puts this bill together, there's some way to at least show some acknowledgement of that, maybe even without additional fiscal costs. So.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, I can assure you that we do have data where children are kept in the hospital for weeks waiting for skilled nursing to become available in the home.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? All right. Oh, Representative Albright.
Yeah, Dr. Albright's right on there. Dr. Abler, I should say. This would be for either the doctor or Ms. Vaughn. But in reading this, I have a two-part question. The first is, it would appear to me that there is a need for increased compensation for the services rendered to the families and to the patients when they're in home. I get that. The first question is, are you only asking for a nurse, or how many caregivers come into the house to take care of one of these critically sick or recovering patients? And how often do they attend to the patient in the home? Is it nonstop? Are they training the parents? Is it just to rehabilitate the patient, or is it more about getting paid more through either MA or insurance? So that's the first part of the question.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I can answer that, particularly from the pediatric perspective. We utilize a qualification tool and an acuity tool. What that looks at, it looks at the stability of the patient, the amount of interventions, the amount of medical devices in the home, feeding pumps, pulse oximeters, ventilator, oxygen, et cetera. Looks at the amount of and number of medications, how often the child needs to be repositioned, how often the child needs to have his airway suction. All these things are added up, and then we use this qualification tool to determine what we think is a reasonable number of hours. That could vary from just 8 hours a day or one shift, or it could go to 24 hours a day for a completely paralyzed ventilator-dependent patient. And these tiny little babies have very small critical airways. One little piece of mucus obstructs their trach, and in a second, they're arresting. So it all varies on the patient. But what we do, as these children improve their clinical conditions, and there are certain diseases where the kids will get better and they will be liberated from their technologies, we take away the nursing hours as the patient clinically improves. These nurses are a valuable resource. We need to distribute this resource among all of these complex children coming out of the children's hospitals.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my understanding is that in the nursing profession, you have specialization, so you don't have a floor nurse is the same as a NICU nurse or a pediatric nurse the same as a geriatric nurse. So I'm sure you're matching them up with the patient. But my question is, are they all going to be compensated similarly based upon the codes that are availed for these, or how do you disseminate that?
Ms. Vaughn, do you want to answer?
Madam Chair, Representative, my name is Susan Wingard. Oh. I'm asking to speak to this issue. Nurses are reimbursed by their level of competency and their years of experience. With the very highly complex patient that we're asking for the third level, you are going to find those nurses more highly compensated than you will a nurse that might be taking care of a less complex patient. Therefore, you are going to see the increases that we are asking for distributed to the nurses according to their skill. But let me make sure that the committee understands one thing. The nurses that work in the hospital are represented by the Minnesota Nurses Association, and the rates that they negotiate go directly to that nurse in its entirety. There's a reason for that. That's because the hospital charges a room fee that takes care of the administrative costs that are associated with providing care to the hospitalized patient. In this particular case, the rates will indeed increase for the nurses, but not all of the rate increase will go directly to the body that's caring for the patient. There will be parts of that rate increase that go to the agency to continue to provide the training, the personnel issues, the regulatory affairs development, etc., that are required to meet the safety requirements of caring for these extraordinarily fragile patients in the home. So will the nurse get an increase? Yes. Will it be based on their experience and skill? Yes. But some of that will also go to the agency to ensure that they can continue to provide this high level of training. One of the things that the Professional Home Care Coalition is attempting to do is to recognize that home care nurses are indeed, what you just said, a specialty. Not unlike an OR nurse, a labor and delivery nurse, a pediatric nurse, home care nurses are extraordinarily specialized in their care for patients. They are flying out there without a net. When you're in the hospital, as Dr. Maynard alluded, and a problem happens, you hit a bell and the cavalry comes. In the home, you are the cavalry. So what we are trying to do is ensure that that high quality of care can continue and that we can expand it so all children and adults who would like to be reunited with their families and their communities have that opportunity.
Okay, well, I have a question. Dr. Maynard, or one of the other testifiers, I think, mentioned the that 77% of the income of the agency goes to the nurses, and there's what amounts to 23% overhead. And Ms. Wingert, you were just referring to that and what's in that overhead, and you know, a lot of that is very understandable. I'm just wondering, I guess it's more of a finance question, but what's the industry average for overhead in an agency? I mean, if you look at a lot of different things that we might do, 23% looks like pretty high overhead. to tell you the truth. And I get what you're just saying, but, you know, is that the industry average?
Madam Chair, I must admit I don't know the specifics of the industry average. One thing that I think the committee needs to be aware of is that there's not a tremendous amount of comparison across the country. Many states do not provide any opportunity for patients to return to their homes. They are forced to live in either a nursing home environment or in the hospital. 23% is required for, and I respectfully disagree that that's a large amount. We have training. We have licensure. We have all of the accoutrements that a nurse must have. We're barely able to cover our administrative costs at 23%. In fact, I guess I could say on many occasions that 23% is inadequate to take care of the training costs alone. When Dr. Maynard talks about children that are in the home with their hearts outside their chest wall, imagine the amount of intensive training that goes on prior to that nurse getting into the home. Representative Albright asked, how many nurses do we put in the home? And the answer to that question is typically one, but not right away. After they've been trained in the agency, they then go into the home with what we call a preceptor. And that preceptor teaches them about that patient. So there's two nurses, payment for one, but two nurses in the home. After that preceptor has gotten all of their stuff done, then there are buddy shifts that last until that nurse that originally came into the home to serve the patient feels competent. Again, there's only reimbursement for one nurse, but until we have a safe care plan, there are more than one nurses in that home. There's also case management that comes as required by both the department and private insurance.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Other questions from members? Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 1988, Representative Lane.
Here's some questions from
Welcome to the committee, and I could, if I could just ask the folks who are leaving, you know, just please do so quietly so that we can continue with our hearing. So welcome to the committee, Representative Lane.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. 5 years ago when my father died, my sisters and I accompanied my mother to the funeral home to make arrangements. As I recall, the discussion had to do with the time and place of the funeral, her stating her choice regarding cremation, little details of how the obituary would be written, whether my mother wanted this or that memorial item or handout at the funeral. The funeral director then said he would write it up and be right back. There was no discussion of specific costs, just yes or no to this or that. Yes, we left with the price information, but no one examined it then. It was all a matter of trust and of the expectation that the cost is the cost and that you just need to do it. It was a couple of years later that my mother remarked on how expensive even that simple funeral was. It was around $6,000, and this is in outstate Minnesota. As the article you have in your packet discusses, it's expensive, it's unavoidable, and no one wants to talk about it. And it's also increasing in cost. In the last decades, it's increased over 35%. The biggest problem is this costly decision is being made immediately after a loved one has died. The emotional vulnerability of the decision maker at that time means cost takes a back seat. Not only is there no emotional wherewithal to fuss over numbers, but it is a time when it is easy to equate love and care with the quality and expense of the items and services being sold. The best way to deal with this is to make the decisions when there's less pressure, not waiting until the loved one has died. That's the time to shop around, to become educated and knowledgeable. This bill helps make educating ourselves about the costs and doing some comparison shopping actually possible for Minnesota families and on their schedule. First, some background. The federal funeral rule requires funeral directors to give consumers an itemized list of all prices for funeral goods and services offered by that funeral provider. They must give this printed general price list to a consumer to take with them when the consumer makes an inquiry in person or upon beginning a discussion about the services or goods they provide. This is the law. It was enacted to counteract the opportunity to quietly slide over costs when dealing with vulnerable adults at a very difficult and emotional time, as exemplified by my mother's simple experience. But today we inquire about prices and seek an education about costs by going to a business's website and looking at their prices and their information online. That's the technological reality of today. And we do it on our time schedule, not setting up a bunch of appointments at different funeral homes. Hence, bringing the intent of the federal funeral rule into this modern reality, consumers ought to be provided with the general price list when they inquire by going to a funeral home's website online. This brings the rule into the 21st century. And we're asking that the funeral homes post their prices online, their general price list online. If the funeral home has no website, this bill does not apply to them. So now I have four caveats. If it has been suggested to me that no other business or profession is required to post their prices online, so it's not fair. My answer is simple. No other business or profession is required by federal law to give their general price list as soon as the discussion begins or someone asks for it. This is a very unique industry. As I said, its services are expensive, unavoidable, and no one wants to talk about it. And this costly decision is made immediately after a loved one has died. It's also been suggested to me that if their prices were online, their competition would know the prices. My answer, I thought competition is what we promoted for the good of the consumer. I'm sure funeral directors would not like to give the impression that they have anything to hide from consumers by keeping their prices harder to access. It's also been suggested to me that we could just let the market encourage the posting of prices online. It is true that several funeral homes have begun posting their general price list on their website. This shows that it is not difficult to do so. But for something to shift by market demand, you need active consumer choice at play. Grieving families have no time for comparison shopping. That's the very reason for the federal funeral rule. It is not a time for asking questions about cost. It's a time of trusting the funeral director and just assuming he or she will take good care of you. Which brings me to the last comment that's been suggested to me. Funeral directors want to have a family come into their establishment so they can explain things and work with them and honor their wishes beyond just price. Great. This is the potential gift of the funeral industry, and it is also their shadow side. As I said, it is a very vulnerable time, and it's easy to equate love and care with the quality and expense of the items and services being sold. So this bill merely extends the federal funeral rule into the modern technological reality of the 21st century. We shop online. We educate ourselves online. We do it daily. We do it easily. Right now, by federal law, the funeral industry must give their printed general price list to a consumer to take with them when the consumer makes an inquiry in person or upon beginning a discussion. This bill extends that intent to making an inquiry online and bringing the current law up to date, and I ask for your support. I have Tom Koberstein here to speak about a group that did a price comparison survey.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lane. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce
yourself. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Koberstein. I'm a retired resident of Minneapolis and a member of the Board of Directors of the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Minnesota, a not-for-profit organization whose mission is education and advocacy for consumer choice in making after-death arrangements. We are an affiliate with the National Funeral Consumers Alliance. I speak in support of this bill, which would require funeral homes with websites to post their general price lists online. To the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Minnesota, the bill is a logical, consumer-friendly, no or low-cost extension of what is already required of funeral homes by the Federal Trade Commission's funeral rule, as Representative Lane said. Now consumers must come to the funeral home in order to receive a GPL. Interestingly enough, Minnesota statute already goes beyond the federal rule by requiring funeral homes in the state of Minnesota to give prices over the phone if they're requested. It could be a confusing conversation, I think, to go through perhaps 16 or more items on a funeral home's price list over the phone, but still, the law does require funeral homes to make that information available by telephone. Funeral homes are not required to mail a consumer a general price list in response to a request by phone or U.S. mail. The general price list, as I said, contains at least 16 specific items of goods and services together with the price list for each item. Funeral homes are also required to provide or show a casket price list and an outer burial container price list. The Funeral Consumers Alliance of Minnesota urges people to plan ahead, to put their wishes for after-death arrangements in writing, to give a copy to their loved ones, and to set aside money to pay for those after-death arrangements. But we all know this doesn't always happen. This is one of the reasons the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Minnesota conducted its first Twin Cities funeral home price survey. We obtained the general price lists of about 80 funeral homes in the metro area, a time-consuming process of calling and explaining what we were doing and having them mailed out to us. From those price lists, we designed a chart showing the prices of six items our consumers most frequently ask about, such as direct cremation and immediate burial. Out of the 80 or so funeral homes we contacted for price lists, less than a dozen currently post price lists on their website. Those that do make it very easy for someone to go to their homepage and see the word pricing or our pricing, click and go to the general price list, which they can view and review at their leisure. The time is long past when in-person visit and telephone contacts are the means by which consumers comparison shop. This bill seeks to update current law by ensuring that if a funeral establishment elects to have a website, the price information already required when the consumer shows up in person is also posted on the website. This is a convenient and compassionate way to help consumers make an informed choice at their leisure about what can be one of their most expensive purchases. Innovative funeral providers have already seen the value of posting prices online. They recognize that consumers looking for funeral information online are interested in knowing how much it will cost, and posting the price list takes a few mouse clicks and costs next to nothing. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Franson, you had a question.
I can wait until after the testifier is done, or are we done?
I think this is the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering here, if there are any other professions, licensed or not, that is required to post price lists on their website. I'm questioning for a business owner who had sent me an email that is concerned that why this business being signaled
as,
out.
Representative Lane. Madam Chair, as I said, this is a very unique industry. They are already required by federal law to give their general price list upon inquiry or beginning a discussion with a person. So, and this being you're not in a very vulnerable state when you go into buy a computer. This is a very unique industry where prices are expensive and unavoidable. Everybody is going to have that experience, and no one wants to talk about it. We don't normally have this discussion, and it's very costly, and it's right after a loved one has died, a very vulnerable time.
Representative Franson?
Sure. Coming from the business owner, so I'll just bring this to the light here, that he says that price lists are often not the best way for consumers to determine the total price for a funeral. The information may not be easily comparable between funeral establishments and could be confusing for consumers to interpret and make the best decision for their families. So, and then also just that personal being able to work with the family on what they can afford in person. So I'm just wondering if you can shed some light on that so I can just email him back.
Representative Lane.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Like I said, this is both the gift of the industry to be able to have that person-to-person connection, and it can be the shadow side, because as the funeral experience that I had with my mother, very, very fine funeral director, but it was not a time for talking about costs. It simply wasn't a time. It was written up, but we went out with the information. We had it all properly legal that we had the information, but it was not a time to even discuss it. The cost was the cost, and that's that. So we need to have access to this information when we're not in that particular state. We need to have it in a way that we can access it, as we do, online, rather than having to make appointments at all these different places to go across town or across the state to cost compare.
May I add something? Thank you.
Mr. Koberstein.
Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. Madam Chair, thank you. Right now, all a person needs to do is go to a funeral home, knock on the door, and say, I would like a general price list. The funeral home is required to hand it to the person. The person can leave. So there doesn't even need to be, there's no requirement for any kind of conversation. And it's interesting that on the website of the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association, on a page titled, How Well Do You Know the Funeral Rule, there's a pop quiz of 30 questions. And all but two of those questions have to do with the price list and prices and what the funeral home may and may not do. For example, question three says, a consumer calls and asks a funeral home to mail its general price list. Does the funeral rule require the funeral home to do so? The answer, no. And goes on like that. So as Representative Lane said, the funeral home, extremely regulated around the funeral rule, and there's obviously concern about being in compliance with that on the part of funeral directors, and it's sort of a constant issue that they're dealing with, making sure that consumers have the information that they need.
Okay. Thank you. We have other questions, and we also do have other testifiers on the bill, so we're going to move along a little bit, if that's okay. Representative Albright and then Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having some experience in the funeral industry, I have some questions with the pertinent to the funeral industry, and that time in every person's life is a very personal experience. You certainly want to be very honorable and respectful to the wishes and or to the vulnerabilities of the family and to the relationship that you have there. My first question would be to, let's say that we go forward with basing prices for, almost like a restaurant for an a la carte menu. How long would you expect to hold a funeral director accountable for that price list in the event that you wanted to, rather than have one aspect, you wanted to have this or that, but it's not on the list and you wanted to include this? I think it's fraught with the illusion that you're getting something when you go in and you talk to a person, you can actually hold them accountable to it. That's the first question, Madam Chair.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The ones that have posted it online simply say, this is our general price list as of this date. It's subject to change at any time without notice. That's standard. That's the way it is today. And then you can call, and it's just their general price list. There's a way that they need to just lay this out and hand it to you, and this is the same thing that would be online unless they chose to do it more informatively. But it, always, you can pick up the phone and call them. You can go visit them. Those will happen. That will be the case. You will go and you will be in their presence and you will talk to them. This is just giving consumers an opportunity to access the information online instead of having to go in and do any kind of cost comparison by going from here to there to there.
Madam Chair, thank you. In greater Minnesota, I'm certainly aware that in times past, when I grew up, that the furniture establishment in some cases used to be the mortuary as well. And it's a sad truth of the economy that we live in, but there's been a great deal of consolidation. Most of those furniture establishments have either gone out of business or the mortuary business itself has consolidated to larger metropolitan areas. So my question is, and I'm trying not to be trite, but when you're price shopping, are you going to say, well, if this isn't the price for that I want, are you going to call up another mortuary or funeral home and say, come pick up, with all due respect, my recently deceased betrothed, and because I'm getting a better price, I'm just... That becomes even more uncomfortable, in my opinion, if you're price shopping the respect that's owed to the deceased.
Representative Lane.
This is one of the most costly things that we will have to do. We ought to have some ability as consumers to control that cost. And you make it, as you said, sound kind of trite, but if a person said, oh, this price that is offered for direct cremation is more than I want to pay, and I've discovered Crescent Tide in St. Paul, who is doing it at a lower price, I'll call up Verlin Stoll and say, would you go this distance? Because it's a piece, he says, for so much cents per mile, and you go, that still makes sense. And now you have a respectful, well-respected funeral director who will handle your situation for you, and you've had some participation in the price of it.
Okay.
Just one quick comment on that.
All right, then we need to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. That proves the point, Representative Lane, to what I'm trying to get at, is that you just indulged in a personal relationship over the phone with a funeral director that goes beyond posting prices on the Internet. And if you go that far and you post prices on the Internet, which whether or not you believe that they are true in fact, you could have vagaries, you could have manipulation of those prices subject to price change or, this is not the posted price for this casket or have you, but then you go and verify that in person. It seems to me that we are requiring more of a respectful relationship for the deceased than is necessary, and you're already having to facilitate that same function, but you're adding an encumbrance on a business that is trying to make a profit and provide a service very needful. So I'm just wondering the need for this type of legislation. It seems like it's born out of a personal experience more than a broad-based circumstance. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, Representative Lane, I don't know if you need to really respond to that. I'm going to move on to Representative Loeffler. We do have two more testifiers. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the questions I would have, and I'd ask the others will be testifying to just, they don't have to address it today, but I want to let them, is that I think there's some additional information that you might want to consider for this bill to be posted as well. For example, how far are they willing to travel to pick up a body? I was involved in a circumstance in which my mother died in the middle of the night in a rural Minnesota, a hospital that doesn't have a morgue. And their intent was to get her out of that bed as quickly as possible because they literally had no place to store her. Mm-hmm. And I spent the middle of the night, just after going through that experience, at the nurse's station with a Yellow Pages, mm-hmm. trying to find a place that would pick her up. And because all of her family and friends were here in the cities, we wanted, transportation down here. And I felt like I was disrupting the medical care in that facility, and it wasn't a very respectful process for her or for anyone who was involved. And I talked to a lot of nursing homes who would not travel that far, had no basis on which to send someone to do that. The closest funeral home was not willing to work with us unless they were going to get the whole package. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very, that happens all the time because people die in all different experiences, whether on vacation or they're at their cabin or whatever. And the other thing is family are not all together in one place anymore. And so that it might be that if you had three children and they're three different states, if something were on the Internet, they could actually confer about what kind of memorial they together collectively thought about. But I do think the idea if we're going to require things on the Internet, I think that would be really practical because it would have been so much easier for me if I could have just found quickly those that said they would travel X number of miles and focus my efforts.
Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Lane.
I'll just say that I'm just looking at taking what it already is in law, the general price list, and having it available online, not adding to that requirement. The price for travel should be in there. And wouldn't it have been easier for you to go quietly online than to make the phone calls?
Yeah. Okay. Well, obviously, this topic does bring up a lot of feelings. Everybody's been through it in one way or another. And anyway, let's move on to our other testifiers, if that's okay, and give them an opportunity. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify in the House File 1988. My name is Roger Bankson, and I am an immediate past president of the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association. MFDA is an association representing funeral homes across the state. I would like to express MFDA's concerns regarding House File 1988, which would require funeral homes with websites to post our price list. First of all, I want to personally thank Representative Lane for sharing the draft of this proposal with us last month. We took it to our board, and our board reviewed it and shared our concerns with Representative Lane. I am recently retired. I have sold my funeral homes that were located in Wilmer, Clare City, Kirkhoven, New London, Belgrade, and Painesville, Minnesota, but have continued to maintain my license and stayed active and involved with the state association because of my interest and concern for funeral establishments in Minnesota. I would like to share my perspective as a real funeral home provider. I understand Representative Lane's perspective that this is helpful to consumers, but I would like to suggest that this proposal would seek to confuse consumers rather than to benefit them. Funeral establishments provide an important and unique service in our communities. It is during a time of death when families come to us for compassion and our expertise to assist them in the most difficult and sensitive time in their lives. We are not selling just product or service, and that's why it is so important to work with families on a one-to-one basis to help them walk through a funeral experience that meets their family needs. Trust me, after 35 plus years as a funeral director, I can assure you that this is not something based just on price. There is so much more that goes into what we do. Frankly, I find it disappointing that the legislation implies we are just about prices and not about the very personal service we provide to families and communities we serve. That being said, I do understand that cost does matter to families. Many individuals prearrange their own funeral services into best serve, and this is also best served on a one-to-one basis. For consumers, pricing on the internet could prove confusing because each funeral home will price their pricing differently. Consumers may not understand the various components that go into the different types of services or products offered. Furthermore, we can help a family identify social service payments they may be eligible for, which would not be evident in just looking at the price list. We will work with them to create a funeral or memorial service for their loved one, which we will provide them the itemization at that time, which no other industry does. Finally, it is important for you to know that the current state law, as they have stated, and the Federal Trade Commission funeral rule requires that price lists be given to consumers when requested in person or on the phone. For that information is available so that we can most be helpful to talk to them and answer any questions they might have for further guidance. This may appear to be a simple requirement. However, funeral homes in greater Minnesota may have multiple locations and the different pricing structure for a variety of reasons, but only one website. Also, there are changes in the pricing that you've heard that may occur and will require ongoing attention even for the simplest of websites that a funeral home may have. If this were law, could we continue to discount our posted prices for a public assisted service or an infant service, or would we be in violation? As I said, it looks simple, but it leaves many questions for funeral homes. On behalf of the MFDA or Minnesota Funeral Directors Association, I encourage you to oppose this legislation that would put a unique requirement on the funeral establishments and will not help the communities and families we serve. Thank you, and I am happy to answer any questions or concerns you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Banks. And are there questions for members? Okay, I have one. Mr. Bankston, you mentioned that if this list posting were required, that there might be a problem, for example, discounting for public assistance or other things. And I wonder if that's a concern right now when the funeral homes have to give out a printed list. I mean, I assume that you'd have the same issue with that list as a list that would be online, or is there a difference?
Madam Chair, when you have a family that visits you one-on-one basis, you're able to talk to them about prices and concerns. And there's many times where we would be aware that this family would be eligible for a public assisted service, and we share that with them. And we do not receive a very, very small portion of what our normal charges would be to assist these families. But every funeral home serves that family in the best way that they can to meet that family's needs.
Mr. Bankston, I guess my question really is whether there's a different, whether putting the prices online would necessarily change that. I think you said something about, that there would be some problem with whether these were the real prices if you had to put them online, and I'm just trying to clarify
Madam Chair, if they're only looking at the prices and they would be eligible for some type of assistance program, that would not be reflected. They would only look at the prices and say, poof, we're not going to talk to those people.
Okay. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question would be somebody on the pro side. It comes to mind that a friend of mine helps the families of, there's a lot of kids in my district and the north side that get shot and unfortunately killed in a lot of the activities. And she does the arrangements. Now, she is often able to get them to waive a lot of their fees. How would that, if they have to set a price schedule on that, could they then vary, for instance, when she comes in with somebody that, with a family like she brings in?
Yeah, Representative Mallory, the bill just requires them to post online the same price list they have already, that's already required. Mm-hmm. So I think that Representative Lane is going to come tell you that this doesn't affect that at all. But here she's coming to the table. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this is the same price list that you get when you walk in, that you're handed. Nothing has changed. If you're eligible for social services, nothing has changed. Every single funeral home would offer them the same as today. This is just giving the consumer the opportunity to get the price list more easily. Same price list.
Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, when you're given the price list, can it not be changed then for that? In other words, I know that she gets a better price than they give to the standard MA person or the standard one just getting the county money. In some cases, they waive it even more. Would she not get that changed? Price list or not?
Representative Lane.
Yes, this is just a listing of prices. It doesn't change what the funeral director or might do with the consumer around those prices. It's just a beginning listing.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have one more testifier. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kathy Lehman Cahoe. I've been a licensed funeral director for almost 30 years in Minnesota, and I manage 8 funeral homes in the Twin Cities area for SCI and Dignity Memorial. I'm also here to testify against House File 1988, which would require the funeral establishments with websites to post their price lists on the website. In addition to the concerns that Roger has raised, I'd like to point out that there are no other states that require price lists to be posted on the funeral establishment website. It's been proposed in other states, but there is no requirement to post the price list currently that is law in any state. As Roger noted, there is a longstanding federal requirement and a Minnesota statute that ensures that consumers get pricing information in person or on the phone. And I understand it might appear to be more consumer-friendly, but and some funeral homes have chosen to put the price list on their website. But we have chosen not to put it on our website because we feel better about having that one-to-one conversation so that families can better understand their options. And if I might add, a general price list has general costs, and sometimes there's other circumstances or options that family might choose that might want to be added or changed, or things that we can inform them of that they wouldn't even know about without having that one-to-one conversation. Funeral homes have different pricing structures, and as has been mentioned, and so sometimes it's difficult to truly compare what you're looking at. So really, the decision about whether to put the price list on their website should be left to each funeral home and not mandated by state law. I'm also not aware, as has been mentioned, of any other businesses in the state that are licensed or not that have been mandated to post their prices on a website. And it's true, we have a unique business, but the face-to-face communication really is the cornerstone of our business. We're not just providing a commodity. It's a very personal experience. I'm not clear on how it would be enforced, or if there would be a penalty for not posting the price list, or if the health department would compare what we've charged families to our price list when they do their inspections, or can we offer pricing, as been mentioned, that's different from our website. So if you're with the family and they have restricted means and we want to offer them discounts to serve this family, if that would be allowed. So it's just not clear to me why this mandate is necessary and really who would benefit from it. And please oppose House File 1988. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone might have.
Okay, thank you. Representative
Schumacher,
thank you. I got the beginning of it. I just couldn't remember the end.
That's fine. To the taxpayers, I know it's going to be an anecdotal response, but I see both sides on this particular issue and kind of what's being made there, and obviously the crux of the conversation is that extra bit that's beyond just the pricing. It's the conversation, it's the whole package, is what we're trying to do, what discounts might be provided based on your situation, and everyone's life is different, so they're going to have different situations. Mm-hmm. Again, I know it's going to be anecdotal, but how often is that in your professional experiences, your 35 years and such, that you do have those other circumstances that allow for these types of things? Is it very common, or is it...
There's frequently requests
through the chair. Ms. Lehman Cahill, go ahead.
There's frequently opportunity to share with the family things that they might not have thought of, and it may be monetarily based and it might not. And we take great pride in being able to personalize those options and what's going to be meaningful for a family emotionally and financially is a part of that. But you know, we don't want a family to ever come through our doors unprepared, so we really are a proponent of pre-planning and to be able to talk through the different options. And we take great pride in exceeding the expectations of the families that we're honored to serve. And a part of that is being able to provide options, talk through frankly on costing, and be that resource for them beforehand and at the time of the death.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd like to maybe put
it. And could I just, we really need to move on, members, so Representative Schumacher, I'm going to let you follow up real quickly, and then we're going to have to conclude because we have other bills we have to hear. Thanks.
Yep, and thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, again, with that, is it your experience when someone comes and gets the card that they do have a lot of questions when they get that, or do they get the card, they go home and think about it, and then come back? What's your personal experiences with that?
The majority of people want to visit with you about it. That's where it's at. And to clarify it, the itemization breaks down into several different items. If a family chooses not to have embalming, they don't pay for the embalming, and the embalming's not done. If the family chooses not to have a visitation, that visitation is not done, they're not paying for it. So they're only paying for the items that they're using, and that's why the individual itemization is given to each family at the time of need.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam.
Okay. The next, I have two bills, and I'm going to go to the testifier table, and Representative Moran will take the gavel. So House File 2005. All right, Representative Liebling, would you like to describe your bill? Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And members, I hope these are, should, I hope, go a little more quickly. I would characterize them a little bit, at least one of them, as kind of a technical bill and sort of updating work that we did before. So these are bills that came to me from the Heart Association, and I'm going to let my testifier describe the bill, and we'll move it along quickly that way. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is Justin Bell. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association here in Minnesota. House File 2005 refers to our statewide acute stroke system of care. For the last several years, the Heart Association, along with stakeholders and partners from across the state, has been designing and implementing a standardized acute stroke system of care for the entire state to standardize and coordinate the care of acute stroke from in the metro and greater Minnesota. With a goal of ensuring that treatment is the same in metro areas as well as in rural areas across our state to ultimately speed up the continuum of care and save those precious minutes in an acute event like a stroke. The bill that we had last year allowed the Department of Health to designate hospitals based on their capacity to treat stroke. So primary and comprehensive stroke centers that are certified nationally are sort of our pinnacles of care. And then throughout the state, the linchpin is really utilizing acute stroke capable hospitals as those first contacts of care for stroke victims where they can be diagnosed and start treatment. The Minnesota Stroke Registry Program has been operational for 7 years in Minnesota, and it's a program where hospitals of any status can voluntarily participate and get data analysis, help, education, and facilitating collaborations between different stakeholders in the world of stroke on how to better give that care. Currently, our primary and we have 17 primary stroke centers in Minnesota. They all participate in the stroke registry or will be coming back on within the next few months. Occasionally, those facilities drop in and out for various reasons. Sometimes it's staffing changes. When they do that, we end up with an incomplete picture of our stroke registry report. So we end up with incomplete data for whatever that quarter is. What we'd like to do, what House File 2005 does, is any hospital that chooses to apply to get designated as a primary or comprehensive stroke center will be required to participate in the stroke registry with a goal of just having consistent reporting.
All right, thank you. Do we have any questions from members? Okay. Any questions from the move on. All right, Representative Liebling.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the next bill that we have is House File 1971. And I don't know if, let's see, we've got a couple of other testifiers for that one, but I'll just start talking about it while they come down, so just move this along a little bit. So many of you have seen these automatic external defibrillation devices. They're now pretty common. We see them around everywhere. And, you know, they're a wonderful thing in the event that you have a sudden need to have your heart restarted. You'd certainly like to have one of these things near you. However, the thing that you would most not like to have is to have one of these things near you with no battery. To have it have not been maintained, where the person who comes to your aid with one of these things suddenly finds that the one that was near them that they know where it is doesn't work. And so the point of this bill is to make sure that when somebody puts up one of these machines, which is a wonderful thing to do and has it in a public place, that there's ongoing maintenance so that precious minutes are not lost while somebody has to search for a second machine, having been kind of misled into thinking there was an operable machine. So I'm going to turn it over now to my testifiers to talk about this a little further.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Katie Tewalt. I'm a paramedic with Allina Health, and I run the Heart Safe Community Program there. Through some of my regular job duties, I help people maintain AEDs across the state, along with helping them procure them. And frequently we run into issues where these AEDs have expired batteries and pads, and that can lead to the AED being completely unusable in the time of its need. Recently I was out at a school and found an AED that was completely non-functional. The nurse there said she didn't really know what to do with the AED, didn't know if it was working properly or not, and thus chose to leave it there. which just shows that this problem can occur anywhere, even with trained medical staff, that these devices, although are easy to use, do require some maintenance, and just having a point of contact, hopefully, for them to receive maintenance notifications as well as answer questions that they may have about their devices.
Yes, can we have our next testifier?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Kim Harkins. I am the program manager of the Minnesota Resuscitation Consortium at the University of Minnesota. What we're talking about with the registry is merely a tool to help these AED owners take better care of their unit. While they've been around for a while and they've been placed in many areas and have that potential of life-saving, as Katie mentioned, even healthcare professionals often are unaware of what they need to do to maintain the device, because batteries and electrodes often expire 2 to 4 years after the initial purchase. It's real easy to forget that there's maintenance that actually needs to be done with the device. The registry is a very simple tool that doesn't take owners very long. It's a short process of them entering the serial number of the device, of the replaceables, the batteries and the electrodes, and then some basic information about the location of the AED. That information is kept in a database which is constantly searching for recalls, equipment recalls, as well as monitoring those dates for replacement on batteries and electrodes. It notifies the owners by sending emails to remind them of replacements several months before, so they have time to anticipate and to set the purchasing into their normal business activities. So it's a very simple, easy tool for them to use to keep these AEDs in working order. Once a person gets these emails, they can update their file online and just say that they've taken care of the batteries and now that new date will be cycled in. If they are unable to update the AED or not willing to, all they need to do then is take it out of service, which then would eliminate the initial issue we talked about of someone going to grab an AED and to find out that it is not ready to be used.
Thank you. Do you have any questions from the members? Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to figure out what this actually does. It doesn't require you to fix it, but it requires you to take it out of service. So let's say there's a little church that has one and they decide that they can't afford, they've shrunk, lost 90% of their parishioners. They wouldn't have to fix it or update it or whatever, but they would have to take it away from, let's say it's in the vestibule or something. They'd have to take it out of there, and I'm wondering whether that would affect in any way, would that add to a possible liability on them if they don't do that?
Mrs. Harkins?
Or is there something the bill provides that there's no liability for
Ms. Harkins?
Something on that.
Minnesotans are covered very well under our Good Samaritan law. AEDs are considered part of the Good Samaritan law, so taking an AED out and using it is covered under that Good Samaritan law. This doesn't require them to take it out of service if they choose not to update it. It merely gives them the tools to ensure that they are aware that updates are needed on the device to make sure that it is in working order. However, the Good Samaritan law would apply.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Liebling.
All right. We're all set.
Okay. We're
Thank
done.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So So, members, we're going to take up Representative Moran's bill, and we would only have 15 minutes left in this hearing, but we can go a little bit later if members would like, and I assume that there'll be a lot of discussion on this bill. So, you know, we can go to 4 o'clock if members are able to do that. We don't have anyone coming in right after us, so let's just plan to do that unless anyone has any objections, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion. So,
Madam Chair, we will not be able to stay till 4 o'clock. We have caucus at 3:45.
Oh, okay. Thank you for letting me know that. We'll try to move along as best we can. So, welcome to the committee. Please proceed, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. In 2012, the legislature passed an imposing law, an unfunded mandate requiring drug testing of participants in the Minnesota Family Investment Program and those who receive general assistance. This unfunded mandate has created significant new responsibilities for counties without providing the necessary funding to implement the staff's training, testing, storage practice, in addition to the computer system modification required to implement this unfunded mandate. Again, this unfunded mandate requires counties to mandatory drug testing. It forces counties and the Minnesota taxpayers to foot the bill for negative drug tests. And the fact is, prior to state laws already allow counties the discretion to test persons with prior convictions. And so what this bill does, that it will make random drug testing of individual receiving GA or MFIP who has been convicted of a felony drug offense since 1997 permissive rather than required. And so I would like to pass this on to my first testifier, Commissioner Tony Carter.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair Liebling, yeah, and committee. Welcome. I'm Ramsey committee. County. Is it okay to proceed?
Please.
Thank you. I'm Ramsey County Commissioner Tony Carter, and I'm here today representing the county and also on behalf of all 87 counties where I serve as president of the Association of Minnesota Counties. Today I have with me two staff people from Ramsey County, Tina Curry, who is our Director of Family and Adult Services, and also Claudia Brewington, our Legislative Liaison. Should you have questions at the end, they will be here to assist me. As you know, counties oversee many of the state and federally mandated health and human services programs that are provided to our residents, and among those, MFIP, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, General Assistance, and MSA. MSA is Minnesota Supplemental Aid, are managed by the counties with oversight from the Department of Human Services. These serve low-income families and individuals with illnesses who are being managed in facilities and or who are of elderly status. The statute, Minnesota 256D, requires that general assistance enrollees who have a felony drug conviction after July 1997 be randomly tested by their county of residence, and a failed test would result in ineligibility for 5 years. Similarly, under 256J, MFIP enrollees with a felony drug conviction in the past 10 years must be randomly tested for drugs by the county where they live. A positive test will result in sanctions, and a second positive test will result in lifetime ineligibility. These are very, very serious and punitive measures, to be sure. So each county will implement the mandate for random drug testing reflective of the number of enrollees that they have in the program that must be tested and the availability of staff and funding to do this work. Speaking of funding, I have to stress that no funding, which Representative Moran already said, was provided to counties to perform these basic or these additional duties. So in other words, this is an unfunded mandate. Basically, counties must either take funding away from another program to pay for this drug testing mandate, or they must collect additional property tax revenue to pay for it. So back to how the program's implemented. For the most part, the implementation will be similar across counties. The county will receive a list from the Department of Human Services of the convicted drug felons who are currently listed as receiving economic assistance of some kind. The county then checks to see if the identified recipients are still enrolled in the assistance programs. The counties then send the clients to be tested a letter informing them that their initial drug testing will need to happen within 10 days. In Ramsey County, this would be performed by the organization RS Eden, unless the client is in a residential treatment facility or has had a drug test within the last 6 months, in which case that drug test result must be produced. After 10 days, if the enrollee has not responded, then a second letter is sent. After an additional 10 days, if there's still no response, a third letter is sent explaining that benefits will be terminated unless they cooperate. Now, once the sample has been submitted in Ramsey County to RS Eden, Eden will notify the county within 3 days of the result of the test. So for general assistance and Minnesota supplemental assistance positive test results, the client is notified that they're ineligible for the program for 5 years, beginning the month following the positive test. For MFIP DWP positive tests, if this is the first positive test, the client is notified that they'll lose 30% of their cash grant, and that any subsequent positive test will then result in a permanent disqualification for cash assistance. For GA, MSA, and MFIP DWP clients, the right is there to appeal, which would generally take 45 to 60 days. The cost of meeting this mandate will depend upon several factors: the number of people who are enrolled or who are to be tested within the county, the frequency of testing for each person, the cost of the test, and of course the staff time involved in meeting the mandate. In Ramsey County, 16,000 people receive general assistance, MSA, MFIP, or DWI. The DHS list of drug felons enrolled in economic assistance programs in Ramsey County in September included the names of 517 of those individuals. This month, when we checked our roster, only 279, or 54%, were still active. So this reflects the typical churn in caseloads where people come on and go off throughout the months. The cost for sending out the notices, for conducting the actual test, for recording the results, for following up on the notices, for penalties and appeals, is expected to be about $51,000 for the first 52 cases being tested in Ramsey, which represents the first round of recipients in the randomized approach. This is roughly $1,000 per case. So the Association of Minnesota Counties and Ramsey County support the flexibility that is proposed in HF 1987. Changing the policy from mandatory to permissive will mean that counties can exercise discretion and determine whether or not it is appropriate for their individual communities and individual families that they will serve. Counties will be able to try to fit this new mandate in with the many other services and duties that the staff tends to on a day-to-day basis. The same workers, by the way, that will oversee this mandate are also the same workers who are providing assistance to help enroll MNsure applicants. This bill allows counties to work with enrollees who are exhibiting drug use issues in ways that have proven to be effective and productive. And it will allow counties to avoid duplicative efforts. Many of the individuals who have drug convictions on their record are currently on probation or on other correctional caseloads. where, in fact, they may be drug tested. So we want to ask a few questions about this mandate. We question specifically whether or not the mandated drug test will actually benefit anyone and the overall purpose of the test. Is it to ensure that public money is used properly, that is, not for drugs? Is it to create a disincentive for MFIP and general assistance recipients so that they will not use illegal drugs? Is it to protect the children in our MFIP families where a parent has been found to be using illicit drugs? Does this drug testing actually achieve those goals? And at what cost, both to our taxpayers as well as to the individuals and the children and families of those who have a drug conviction on their record? And do these drug tests actually perpetuate stereotypes or perhaps increase disparities? Here's what we know. First of all, in Ramsey County, of those who are eligible to be tested, the average age is 45. That in comparison to the average age in the county of 34. And the tendency is for drug abuse to decrease as individuals age. Second, MFIP recipients, according to studies by the National Institute of Health and numerous others, are actually less likely than the general public to use illicit drugs. Third, in a Florida recent experience with drug testing, this population was found to test positively in only 2% of the tests done. In Ramsey County, people of color will be disproportionately impacted. As of those still active on our caseloads will be eligible, 67% are actually people of color, including 61% who are black or African American. And in the 2010 census, only 9% were black or African American. Drilling down a little bit further, of the categories that are eligible for testing, the greatest number appear in the MSA assistance category. These are the aged, the blind, and the disabled who are receiving SSI.
Yeah. Commissioner, excuse me. I just want to, we need to kind of wrap it up.
All right.
If you could. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry to rush you.
That's okay. I'll just say that in the second most likely category, 95% are either ill or incapacitated or in facilities or are elderly as well. So we have other proven ways of addressing this to protect public money to help individuals and families touched by drug abuse. Adopting the language in HF 97 will allow us to thoughtfully employ those ways of testing drug enrollees. So AMC and the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners would respectfully urge you to approve this bill for passage. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Members, we've reached the end of our time. I know some of you have to be elsewhere. And I apologize. It was not my idea to cut off debate, and we're not going to pass this along or do anything with it without giving a full opportunity for debate on the bill. So, you know, rest easy. And I know that a couple of you have questions, which I'll allow in just a second. But I also just wanted to note we had another testifier who's also graciously told us she can wait. And so we're not going to be able to really complete the hearing on the bill today. I do want to note that Representative Drazkowski had also asked to testify here today, and he is graciously, I asked him to really think that through, because it's kind of not our practice to have legislators testify in front of committees on which they don't sit. And he's graciously agreed to do his give us his thoughts in a letter instead, so I want to just extend appreciation to him for that. And we will have a full discussion on this before it moves any further, so I just want to let people know that. In light of that, Representative Gruenhagen, did you want to ask or make a comment or something?
Madam Chair, I could wait. It's quarter to, and
yeah,
you know, if that's
okay.
All right,
and we'll
you,
give you a full opportunity. And Representative okay. Huntley?
Madam Chair and Representative Moran, there's been a whole series of articles in the national newspapers about how this has failed in state after state after state. And I think it might be advantageous if you had the legislative library look up a few of those and then have them Xeroxed and handed out. It doesn't save money, it costs money.
Okay, Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on that, I know that the people that are targeted use it far less than the average, but I think some states that had it have gotten rid of it, and I'd like to know that. But I also know there has been some studies of the overall cost, actually, when you look at the cost of crime, the extra cost for other things being a huge addition to the cost to the counties, and I'd like to have that by the time of the next hearing.
Okay. Thank you, members. So in view of the time here, thank you, everybody, for attending and for your attention, and we are adjourned.